Dr. Donna E. Shalala, Assistant Secretary for Policy Development and Research, Department of Housing and Urban Development. To give you some background information on Dr. Shalala, she was nominated Assistant Secretary for Policy Development and Research by President Jimmy Carter on March 21st and confirmed by the Senate on April 7th. She's a research scholar and specialist in state and urban government and finance with extensive published writings. Dr. Shalala comes to HUD from Teachers College, Columbia University, where she was an associate professor and chairwoman, program in politics and education. She's a native of Cleveland, Ohio. She is a recipient of several awards, including election in 1976 to the National Academy of Public Administration, an LHD from Marymount Manhattan College and the American Association of Universities Women's Young Scholar Award, and a Guggenheim Fellowship in 1976. Dr. Shalala in 1975 was named Director and Treasurer of the Municipal Assistance Corporation, Big Mac, the agency created to solve New York City's financial problems. She has been consultant to numerous research and study groups, including the Connecticut Commission to Study School Finance and Equal Educational Opportunities, National Project on Ethic America, American Jewish Committee, the New York State Commission on Quality, Cost, and Financing of Elementary and Secondary Education, and Ohio Commission on Local Government Services. She is a member of the editorial board of the Public Administration Review. Dr. Shalala received a Bachelor's of Arts degree in 1962 from Western College for Women, Oxford, Ohio, an MA and PhD from the Maxwell School of Citizenship and Public Affairs at Syracuse University. She served as a Peace Corps volunteer in Iran from 1962 to 1964. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming our distinguished lecturer from the top, Dr. Donna Shalala from HUD.
Thank you very much. Those kinds of credits, I ought to be unintelligible. I have a very busy schedule for the last 3 weeks and did not have time to really prepare anything for this, and it was really the young women on my personal staff, the special assistants, that insisted I come down out to the IWY conference. And originally, the general counsel of HUD, Ruth Prokoff, was going to come out. But they insisted that I came out, not because they had any questions about me being a feminist, but because they believed that I had not made a serious academic commitment to the women's movement or to women's studies in terms of my own career. So I made a deal with them. I told them that I would come out and give this distinguished lecture if they would write the lecture for me. And they asked me whether I could commit, whether they could commit me to a number of things in terms of the research budget at HUD. And I said yes. If they got ample participation in HUD from the other women, I would do whatever was in the speech. So they have written a speech for me, which I have just read. And the speech is about, I told them to pick some field that I knew something about, and to make sure that it was a field in which there was a women's dimension, an area in which the federal government ought to get active. So as a surprise to me, part of the $50 million research budget, which I direct at the Department of Housing and Urban Development, is committed in this speech. So not only am I going to talk to you a bit about finance, which is my specialty, and women in the mortgage market, but I am simultaneously, it seems, going to commit HUD and the research budget of the Department of Housing and Urban Development to do something about the problem. So I thought what I might do for a few minutes is to take my young colleagues seriously and read what they said that I should say to you, and then make a commitment to all of you to commit part of the budget. I can't imagine anything I'd rather do than come out to Houston for this week. I'm, of course, as a New Yorker, a personal friend of many of the leaders in the women's movement. And I was on the floor a couple of minutes ago helping some friends organize. But I have not been a heavy participant. I'm one of the women in this country that at one point made a choice between full-time activities within the women's movement or making it more directly or indirectly in terms of the profession. I work for Patricia Roberts Harris. I'm one of the lucky high appointees in the Carter administration because I actually work for one of the women cabinet officers. Pat Harris is one of the two women that are cabinet officers in the federal government. She herself, of the appointments that she's controlled, the appointments that are at senior level in the Department of Housing and Urban Development, the political appointees, half of her appointments have gone to women. She has made a particularly deep commitment to the women's movement herself. I have never spoken or been on a list with so many distinguished women, and therefore I am really not going to take a lot of time and hope to answer some of your questions. One of the areas which this conference is working on is women in finance. And the goal here, as I understand it, is not merely to study the role of women in economic development, but to try to identify the barriers to their full economic participation and to see whether you can get people like me that actually have some power to help develop techniques to destroy some of the barriers women having access. And what I would like to do for a couple of minutes is really explore that topic. A couple of years ago, my department commissioned a study. The study was prepared by the National Council of Negro Women, and it showed, as most of us already knew, but it documented that women were being discriminated against when they tried to purchase a house. The report showed in enormous detail that men and women with equal incomes in similar situations did not have equal access to the mortgage market. Now, that's not surprising to any of us. Such obvious to us conclusions, though, are immensely important to be put before the general public, because the public is more likely to take cognizance of the facts when they're presented in some kind of a scientific form. And our first cut was a pretty good scientific study that demonstrated with some pretty good social science research techniques. So that study proved that the lenders discriminated against women by making it more difficult for them to obtain credit, specifically to obtain mortgages and loans than for their male counterparts. To make matters worse, sex discrimination was often layered with other forms of discrimination against race, marital status, and source of income. For example, we found that lending institutions engaged in a practice of discounting a woman's income when she applied for mortgage credit. Let me explain what I mean by that. Suddenly, the income which supported children, the income that was used to supply food, and the income which was applied to taxes would become invisible when calculating a woman's income. If a woman was in her childbearing years, we found out in her study that her income might be discounted by as much as 90%. The older she got, the more visible her income became, until after the menopause, all of her income would be counted. So what we found was not only a pattern of discrimination because of sex, but layered in terms of age, and, of course, layered in terms of race. Not often do we find the financial world so kindly disposed to the postmenopausal woman. I suppose we were expected to be grateful that older women had an earlier, easier time at least the studies revealed, obtaining some kind of credit. Also know that in terms of establishing some kind of credit, married women were not generally permitted to establish credit in their own name. And if you were divorced or if you were widowed, there were often incredible obstacles to your getting some kind of credit, particularly if you wanted to buy your own home. As for single women, here again, even those with steady, high-paying jobs were not considered good risks. I suppose the bankers considered their own personal charms, when they were thinking about single women, and they decided that they couldn't trust the financial soundness of women who chose not to get married. And there was a clear pattern of prejudice in our studies among single women as well as among married women. Another problem was the prejudice shown by real estate brokers in showing women homes. And I'm sure that many of you know this firsthand, the power of real estate agents to steer you away from the type of housing you want, but housing that they think is inappropriate for you. Of course, we've always had more data on this issue, and HUD continues to study this issue as it relates to race. We have recently been in the field, in a national field sample on the race issue and discrimination in the mortgage market. We sent the pairs out, a black person and a white person, and had them apply for the same house to the same real estate agency, and then documented that pattern of discrimination. I was amused because we did this in a big national sample. The secretary came in one day and she said, "Gee, did you see this message that went out to all the real estate agents in Washington, D.C.?" And the message was that that Assistant Secretary Shalala at HUD was in the field with this big discrimination study, and the Washington, D.C. real estate agents should clean up their act because we were going to be studying them for a month. And I started to laugh, and the secretary said, "But why are you laughing? Isn't it wonderful that they decide to clean up their act, at least during the period when you were studying them?" And I said, "But we're not studying them. Washington, D.C. is not in our sample." My staff, which is very scientific, suggested on that basis we should simply announce that we're in the field studying all the time, and that would allow people to... So that we have had a series of studies which look at both the layering and the discrimination against blacks, but particularly most recently the discrimination against women. Well, the list of abuses went on and on that we found, but in 1974, the Federal Equal Credit Opportunity Act was made into law, and as some of you know, its purpose was to do away with the abuses that I just described, even though we found these abuses in 1976 and in part of 1977. All that act did was make it illegal to discriminate on the basis of sex or race or anything else. But the effects of the discrimination practices remain, and we believe they're going to take years to eradicate. Now, how can we do it? Well, my young colleagues have designed a plan for us. The first step, they suggest, in speeding up the process is that we have to publicize the results of another HUD-funded study called Women in the Mortgage Market. And it's just come off the press, and it hasn't gotten around to all parts of the country, but we're in the process of rewriting it and translating it into a variety of different kinds of publications. If you ask a mortgage lender or a real estate dealer why they treat women as if they were high risks, they'd probably say to you that women don't perform well economically. Certainly that they don't perform as well as men do, and that they're not economically stable, and you simply can't rely on them to have a steady income. Well, this study examined that specific question. It looked at the income growth and the income stability of women during the early years of a mortgage. And guess what we found? We found that women, and I quote, were performing substantially better with respect to income growth and stability than any of those mortgage bankers would have expected. To give you one specific example, the single woman's income growth and stability were on a par with the income growth and stability of the married man who headed a family in which the wife didn't work. What's additionally important here is that the man-headed one-earner family, what the industry describes as its standard, the industry standard. In other words, the standard against which others are measured. And until this study came up, we didn't measure women against that standard or with that standard. The mortgage bankers in particular, assumed that women weren't coming anywhere near the standard. And what we found was women in a variety of circumstances were exceeding the standard or certainly coming up to the standards. And it was true of all the income classes that the mortgage bankers have assumed were unstable. Well, it's tough to destroy these kinds of myths. And we're not going to do it by doing anything else except getting the word out. It's not simply a matter of passing laws at the federal level or at the state level. We think that it's in part a dissemination effort that has to take place. We're going to use a variety of new studies that build on our original study of women in the mortgage market. And what we intend to do is to make a major impact on the consciousness of mortgage bankers across the country. More importantly, we intend to have an impact on their behavior. Let me put it another way, and HUD will soon be prepared to make a major statement, a policy statement on this issue. HUD is going to take the initiative to wipe out the myths that are surrounding women in mortgage lending practices. To do so, we're going to mount a new project that will have a number of parts. First, we're going to compile data on the rates of acceptance and denial of mortgage loan applications from specific groups of women, from single women, from women heads of households, and from married women. Second, we will look to see whether women who are actually attempting to purchase homes are representative samples of the potential pool of women capable of purchasing homes. Third, we're going to try to find out whether those mortgage applications that are turned down or withdrawn are being turned down or withdrawn on criteria consistent with the Equal Credit Opportunity Act and the Community Development Act of 1974. And fourth, we're going to attempt to determine if the lending institutions require different lending criteria for different categories of people. For example, we hope to discover as accurately as possible whether sex, marital status, or income level has an effect on an individual's access to credit. But more importantly, what we're going to do is we're going to take all of this information out and we're going to make sure that every mortgage lender in this country has sitting on his desk not simply a great big thick study, but a short report, the same kind of thing that they get from their own actuaries, that put it on tables in a form that they understand and try to have an impact on their behavior. My colleagues at the moment, I understand, are mounting a series of workshops around the country, some of them associated with the women's banks, but more importantly, associated with the savings and loan associations and the major banking organizations, to see whether we can begin by talking to the leaders of those organizations and then go perhaps city by city and try to have an impact in terms of information. In this case, what we will have is hard economic data to demonstrate that women are good risks, and we think that since it isn't as soft an area as some of the other discrimination areas are, that we might be able to have some kind of an impact. What we want to demonstrate is that lending money to women is good business, and that the evidence in which the bankers have been operating on is totally inaccurate. So that's the program. That's what we're going to start doing for the next couple of years at HUD. We thought about a variety of other areas. One of the things that happens when a lot of women get into an agency is they not only sit around figuring out how they can take over the agency, but they sit around and figure out what are some of the things that they can do specifically for the women's movement. What my young colleagues have really done is ask that we take on a very tough issue, a specific problem area, and that we bring to bear as much information as we have, and then we put together enough money to go out and try to change the behavior in the financial community. They did not put any numbers on and tell me how much money I was committed, but I'm assuming from the description of what we intend to do in the next year and a half that we're going to be spending $1 million trying to have some kind of impact on the behavior of the mortgage market in relationship to women. I think it's an exciting program. I think it's the kind of thing that the federal government ought to be doing in all of its programs, that we ought to be thinking about that dimension and go systematically through our programs and see if we can eliminate discriminatory practices. To the extent that we can encourage home ownership among women, it provides us at least with an opportunity to get women to begin to accumulate capital and therefore accumulate power in a way that they haven't in the stock market. I would suggest that at least in the largest metropolitan areas in this country, land and homes continue to be one of the better ways of accumulating capital. This is a simple, straightforward one if we can get women access to the credit markets and an ability to borrow the way other people have. I'm amused by us starting with this program because I've been trying to buy a house in Washington, and my problem is not a problem of discrimination, but a problem of the mortgage market being willing to fall over itself to give an assistant secretary of HUD all the credit that they want. And my problem is to hold them off and to find what we had to do is we had to write letters to all of them and to find out what the average amount of money they were willing to lend me and then make a choice to protect me as opposed to them giving me a 95% loan of some kind or another. So there is some reverse discrimination depending on where you are in the system. Why don't I finish there and I'd be happy to answer the question, because I just committed myself to a $1 million program and to 2 years of my life running around the country talking about women in the mortgage market. I'd be happy to answer any of your questions. Yes. That's right. We will never get the staffing, particularly if our leader, the president, is serious about balancing the budget, which I understand that he is. I have no reason to believe that he's not. We will never get the kind of staffing that we need to properly monitor these fair housing laws, whether it's a credit opportunity law or others. What we will try to do is to do more regulatory work and to tighten up on that, but to simultaneously try to get at some of the issues that people raise when they're redlining and doing some of those other things. We can write into regs, for example, some tough regulations that make it difficult for people to use our CD money and some of our other kinds of money if there's any evidence of redlining. You will find I chair the interagency task force on redlining with John Hyman, the Comptroller of the Currency, and we intend in the next 2 weeks to make recommendations to the President in the redlining area. More importantly, we can do some things to eliminate the risk problem. We are now looking at a variety of things like coinsurance so that those bankers cannot raise the issue about risk, and so that neighborhoods that are just beginning to tip over have more stability in them because we're using a variety of financial instruments. I happen to think the racial thing, particularly as it relates to poverty, is more complicated in some ways than the pattern of women's discrimination, and that we will be more successful in the area of women across the board than we will in lower income groups for women or on racial minorities. And that's because that is the area where it's really layered and where HUD really has to develop a new series of financial instruments, as well as perhaps really tying CD money and some other kinds of activities to regs.
What is your area doing about the deterioration of some of these complexes that were purchased, with grants through HUD? Like in our area, they had a group to get up and build a complex for low income, and this was several years ago.
Yeah.
Now that all people have been evacuated by court order, and now they have found out that none of the housing code standards were met.
The 236,
230, yeah. And now I'm involved in that now. And now they're wanting to sell it. People are out. But what can we do to make sure that whoever decides it fixes it like it's supposed to be fixed? Yeah. And it's a brand new complex, you sure fit.
Yeah.
And,
what city is this in?
In Anderson, Indiana. They have officials.
I've actually been to Anderson, Indiana. I have been to Anderson, Indiana, but not to see a housing project. Let me say a couple of things about the housing projects. When Pat Harris interviewed me for this job, I said to her, I don't want to work for you. You're some landlord. I spent all of my life criticizing HUD. The last thing on earth I want to do is be on the inside. I said, do you realize what you've gotten yourself into, because you're the biggest slum landlord in this country, and we're going to have to do something about that. And if I come in, I just don't want to be a slum landlord. And she promised me that she didn't either, and that we were going to do something about the pattern that HUD had established, particularly with multifamily buildings going into default without proper maintenance. It is a problem which defies easy solution, but the simple answers are better management and subsidies, deeper subsidies, for both the maintenance and for the people that live in the buildings. HUD has just finished a major policy report for the secretary specifically on these kinds of projects, on what we call trouble projects. We have made a recommendation to the president, and we will hear in the next 2 weeks what his judgment is on that recommendation, in terms of whether we're going to be able to go in and take care of some of those buildings. Now, in some cases, they're in the hands of local housing authorities that we simply have provided some of the financing money, and therefore we can do very little except provide more subsidy money. We can't do much on the management side. We are well aware of that problem. It is the biggest problem that we have within the department, and that is a bunch of multifamily buildings that in many cases were badly financed, badly constructed, that we're now stuck with, in the sense that you don't want to tear them down, but it's going to cost a lot of money to spend some time fixing them up. I think I better take another question. I'll be happy to talk in detail about some of the HUD stuff later. Any other questions? Yeah. New towns. We don't. As far as I can tell, we have had very little success in this country trying to get some income integration into subsidized housing, whether it's assisted housing or insured housing. Everybody starts out by saying they're going to have an income integrated building, and they're only going to have partial subsidies. In a few very large cities, they've gotten some income integration, but it still is what you're talking about, is moderate and low income people being mixed. It is particularly true in our family buildings in public housing where we've had trouble getting income integration. We've got some tough rules in HUD, in part imposed by the law, as to where we can place buildings, and supposedly that'll have some income. But to the extent that central cities in this country, the distressed cities, are emptying out of their population, they're losing middle and upper income people. The kinds of upper income people that are coming back don't want to live in those kinds of buildings. They're really upper income. We're not going to be able to do it very much about income integration. Now, my colleagues at HUD might tell you something else, because I'm sure that the official position, which I'm not sure I know, is that of course we're going to get income integration, but the facts are quite different on income integration. We've had some luck when we put huge subsidies in. The Manhattan Plaza complex on 42nd Street in New York City is a building taken over by Actors Equity, and what you really have there is a bunch of actors that in any other part of the world would have higher incomes, so that it's almost a class integration that you have there, but everybody at the same income level. And you have a mixture of elderly, welfare families, very few, but some welfare families, and actors. And in that building, we adjust the income depending on whether they're in a play or not, so that when they're making money, they pay the rent, and when they're not, we adjust the rent with our Section 8 subsidy.